challenge. This is put on by the ALS Association in America. Of course, ALS, otherwise known as Lou Gehrig's disease, is a neurological disorder, and the Ice Bucket Challenge is a fundraising method to both raise awareness and raise funds to combat the disease and to help the association keep the lights on, keep the doors open, that sort of thing. And it's sort of taken off like wildfire. It spread across America. It spread around the world thanks to celebrities who are doing the Ice Bucket Challenge, which is basically they dump a bucket of ice cold water on their heads and then they challenge three people to do the same or donate to the ALS Association. Now, most of them are actually donating and dumping buckets of water on their head. It wouldn't really make a lot of sense if you use it as an opportunity to not donate to charity. But and amazingly, you know, this is working. This is working really well. The ALS Society has raised more money than they have ever fundraised. The amount is something crazy, about triple or so what they raised in an entire year for their last fundraising campaign, and they've done it in a matter of weeks. It's got everybody talking. Everybody and their dog has an opinion on the Ice Bucket Challenge, whether they're calling it slacktivism, whether they're calling it a sort of feel-good but do-nothing mentality, or criticizing the social nature of the challenge and how it's spreading by social media, criticizing the kind of narcissism that goes along with it. Overall, lots of opinions out there. Coming at it from my point of view, you know, the real question here is, how much money have they raised? At the end of the day, if they're making money, if they're raising money, and if that money is going to support the organization and making a difference for people with ALS, I don't know. I mean, is it really a big deal to complain about this? I don't know. We're not actually going to devote the entire show today to the Ice Bucket Challenge. I thought it might be a good idea to wait for the challenge to run its course, depending if they're going to eventually run its course, see how much money they actually raise, and get some feedback from people about what they thought about it. Maybe get some industry experts to come on the show and talk about it. So if you're looking forward to that, let us know. If you have any questions or thoughts about the Ice Bucket Challenge that you'd like to share with us, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com and feel free to visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. While you're there, you can check out past episodes of The Sector, download them in podcast form if you want to take them on the go. You can also read our show notes and double-check that I'm actually talking about real stuff and not just a crazy person talking into a microphone. Although that could also be true in other ways. But of course, we all hope that it's not. And while you're online, be sure to swing by facebook.com/sectorpodcast, and you can like us and get all our updates in your Facebook feed, assuming that Facebook doesn't throttle our posts and only 10% of you actually end up seeing it. And we're also on Twitter at Sector Podcast, as am I at Ethan Clow on Twitter. Well, before we go on with the show, let's take a quick break here on The Sector, and we'll be back after this.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
So whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of
cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electropop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, Browns.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense, and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow across it, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville.
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, talking about nonprofits, social justice, activism, and all that good stuff. Well, before the break, we were just mentioning the Ice Bucket Challenge. And as I mentioned, you've probably heard about it. You've probably seen the videos on YouTube or seen the call-outs on Twitter. Now, I mean, a lot of people haven't exactly been happy to see this viral meme spread around. Which is interesting to me from the point of view of a nonprofit. If you think about it in terms of getting your message out there, raising awareness, fundraising, of course, but also utilizing social media, utilizing that ability to go viral, as they say, to get your message out there, to reach a lot of people, and at the same time, do so in a way that's entertaining, but also exciting, that's also galvanizing. And it's kind of funny because looking at some of the backlash against the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge thing, it's sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you don't make these social media attempts, you tend to get viewed as kind of a dinosaur, an old fogey nonprofit that's afraid of social media, that's afraid to get out there, that's afraid to embrace new technology and new trends. But conversely, if you do go out there and you do embrace these new trends and you happen to be successful at it, then you become a slacktivist. You're promoting armchair activism. You're not really doing the real work, whatever real actually means in this case. So it's a little bit surprising to see that kind of reaction. Although, you know, maybe we shouldn't be surprised. Maybe we should expect that reaction. Now, as I mentioned, I don't want to get too far into this on today's show, because we have a lot of great content anyway. But let's keep this in mind, and for a future episode, we'll dive into this a bit more. Well, moving on, another interesting social meme that's been spreading around lately, I've seen it a ton on Facebook and Twitter, is a new infographic, which I believe came off of Vox.com. Ironically talking about the Ice Bucket Challenge. I'm not 100% sure if this is where it originated or if this is simply where it gained popularity, so I do apologize if I get that wrong. But anyway, the infographic shows on one side money raised for various disease-related causes. Cancer, HIV, AIDS, suicide, heart disease, etc. On the other side shows the amount of deaths that occur in the U.S., from these diseases. And the interesting aspect about this infographic is the dichotomy. On one side, the biggest circle for money raised is breast cancer, with around $257.8 million. And on the other side, with deaths, you have heart disease, which claimed about $596,577. So, and they're different colors, they're different shapes, so you sort of get a good visual idea of money raised versus what is a, you know, a pressing killer. And it's ironic because when you look at it, the top diseases that are killers in the U.S., heart disease being the first one, the second one being chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, the third being diabetes, and then finally the fourth one is breast cancer. Now, if you look at the other side of the infographic, of course, you see that breast cancer is the number one disease that we're fundraising for, we as in America. And the second one is prostate cancer. The third one is heart disease. And then rounding out as the fourth category is ALS. I guess we can expect that number to go up a lot next year. And then finally, there are things like HIV, AIDS, and the list goes down a little bit further. So this is a good indication of how certain diseases are trendy, if we can use that word. I think it's kind of offensive to use that word, but let's go with it for the moment. So how certain diseases are trendy and they fundraise a lot versus the actual reality, in which case you see certain diseases actually kill a lot more people. You know, for instance, breast cancer, the number listed on this infographic is 41,000. HIV AIDS is 7,000, and so forth and so forth. So this is a really good example of how we've got our priorities all mixed up, right? No, it's not a good example. It is a stupid example. Okay, I apologize. I shouldn't say stupid. That goes against one of my cardinal rules here in the sector. Let's not put other organizations down. Let's try to educate and understand, but let's not be snarky about it. And I know fans of Radio Free Thinker will be going, yeah, right. But anyway, no, I don't think this is a good infographic. I think this is sort of represents what we've been talking about in terms of not really understanding how the fundraising and nonprofit sector really works. So when we look at an infographic like this and we see heart disease way up there and comparatively breast cancer way up there and they don't match up, we instantly go, wait a second, something fishy is happening here, something nefarious. Well, you could jump to that conclusion, but you could also look at why breast cancer death rates are so low. Could it be that the rates are so low because we fundraise a whole crap load of money to research and raise awareness? Yeah, it is. And if you look at some of the other big killers, heart disease, diabetes, these diseases are perhaps, and this is kind of a difficult concept to think about it, but these diseases are often related to a lifestyle. Poor nutrition, diet, lack of exercise, sedentary lifestyle, you know, symptoms, I guess you could say, of Western civilization. Things like cancer, AIDS, diseases like that, sure, they could be trendy, in quotation marks, but they often have the other side effect of striking down anyone at any time. And I think that there's a reason why we tend to lean towards the indiscriminate killers as opposed to the diseases that happen to follow a predictive line. You know, if you go to your doctor and say, doctor, for lunch today, I had 2 Big Macs and a chocolate milkshake. For dinner, I'm going to have a steak. And for breakfast the next morning, I'm going to have a giant latte stuffed with chicken wings. You know, your doctor might look at you and go, you know, you're kind of shortening your lifespan a little bit. And to a certain extent, I think that that is representative in the way that we look at these diseases. We think of things like heart disease, diabetes, as diseases that are brought on by somebody's action or inaction. And I'm not saying that's right. In fact, I'm almost certainly going to say that's the wrong way of looking at it, because these diseases can strike anybody as well. And we all know that. The science is very clear. But the problem is that they have far more vectors for catching these diseases, as opposed to breast cancer, which, aside from smoking or exposing yourself to certain carcinogens, it can seem like a pretty much indiscriminate, one day you're just walking along, all of a sudden, boom, breast cancer, your life changes. So there's a reason why these diseases get more attention and more play in the nonprofit sector and are more successful at raising money. Now, again, this is not to suggest that we should just wipe our hands and we're done with it and this isn't an issue. But I think it does betray a misunderstanding of how the nonprofit sector operates in response to diseases like this. One of the interesting things to point out is that breast cancer survival rates have increased dramatically over the last 100 years. In some cases, the survival rates have gone from 10% to the 90% section, depending on the type of breast cancer and, you know, where you were living at the time. This is really great progress, of course. And one of the reasons why this progress has been made, and one of the reasons why we're able to get to a good point where breast cancer is not killing as many people anymore, is because of the awareness raising. It's because of the new research that's been doing, that's been invested in because of fundraising efforts. And also by the attention that it gets from policymakers, you know, focusing on breast cancer research. And the added benefit, of course, is that cancer research is linked to the other forms of cancer that exist. So as we get better at treating breast cancer, we'll get better at treating other forms of cancer. Now, the awareness aspect is really important as well, because as we've raised awareness for breast cancer, more women are getting breast cancer examinations at a younger age. They're catching the disease at a younger age, and also before it can reach more a dangerous stage of development, so that they're able to get treatment faster and more safely. All of these factors will lower the death rate. So again, I think of the infographic, the heart's in the right place, but to look at this and say we're funding all the wrong things or our priorities are all wrong is missing the point. The reason why we can make a chart like this and see the fact that breast cancer death rates are really low is because we're fundraising a whole lot load of money. It's going into research, it's going into development, it's raising awareness, and it's having an impact. And likewise, you can probably draw up these charts for different diseases, prostate cancer, HIV and AIDS, and look at how we're raising a whole lot of money in certain areas. Meanwhile, other areas are not getting a lot of money. You know, ALS was a great example. You had a situation where it wasn't raising a lot of money. It wasn't high on the radar of anybody. And now it is. Now it's front and center. Everybody's screaming about slacktivism. But the point being is that the more money that you raise, the bigger effect it's going to have on that disease. So sure, if you raise $200 million, that's going to have a bigger impact, and you're going to see, hopefully, a reduction in infections and deaths, increased treatment, increased awareness. That's a good thing. That means it's working. So again, the infographic in question, like I said, the heart's in the right place. It's good to be aware of these things, but we don't want to jump to conclusions that just because there is a low death rate for a disease and there's a high amount of fundraising going on, that money's being wasted or something. There are so many facets to a disease that you can fundraise for. It doesn't necessarily have to be research and development or treatment. It can also be assistance for families who are going through treatment, help for people who can't afford treatment, help for people who need counseling to get on with their lives. There's so many extra reasons why certain diseases tend to fundraise more. And that's just a sort of a factor of the way of the nonprofit sector. And again, I think if people have a major problem with this, well, then stop complaining, stop tweeting about it and writing about it on Facebook, open up your wallet and make a difference. Let's take a quick break here on the sector. We'll be back with more after this.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
My address is 2904 Salisbury Street.
I can't understand you. You need to speak English.
Hey, Polly, that remark is totally inappropriate. I know you're new here, but this is a safe harbor office. We're committed to treating all of our clients respectfully.
What would you do if you were this witness? Safe Harbor Respect for All provides diversity workshops across Canada with funding from the Government of Canada. Visit safeharbor.ca. Respect for All. Pass it on.
And we're back on the sector here on CITR. But first, a little musical interlude. This is Always with Adult Diversion. Take a listen. On the sector with me, Ethan Clow. Thank you for that musical interlude. I hope you enjoyed it. Quite the popular song on the charts right now. That's Always, and the song title is Adult Diversion. Let's get back to the show. So we're just finishing up our discussion on that recent viral infographic discussing which diseases are funded through fundraising efforts and what diseases actually kill people. So you heard me give my point of view on that. I would love to hear your point of view. Even if you disagree with me, that's okay. We're allowed to disagree here on The Sector. You can email us your thoughts at sectorpodcast@gmail.com or visit us on Facebook or on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. Let us know. Now, speaking of hearing from you, it's time to look at the big question of the week. Now, you had an extra week to think about this since we took last week off on the sector. But last week I asked you about this notion of pinkwashing, of the sort of awareness-raising industry that has sprung up around things like breast cancer awareness or any kind of run for the cure, walk for the cure, do something for a cure. And I mean, of course, I guess it would also factor in dump a bucket of ice water on your head for the cure. This sort of cottage industry that has evolved. And it also kind of goes into the question of corporate social responsibility, as I mentioned last time on the show, of organizations that kind of gussy themselves up in the colors and the banners of a cause, of a nonprofit, of a mission. And, you know, they raise money, they raise awareness, but are they really helping? Are they actually contributing something to the effort? Or is it simply a marketing ploy, a way to get on the radar of the buying public to, you know, get in their good book? So what do you think? What is the issue at hand here? Do we have an opinion on pinkwashing? Do we have an opinion on the corporate buy-in or the maybe sellout of these important causes and missions? A lot of the responses that I got indicated a kind of skepticism of corporate sponsorship, to the point of view that, you know, Coca-Cola or Pepsi or Nike or whoever, when they throw a big fundraising event, whether it's a walk for the cure or a bike ride for the cure, the notion being that these corporations are getting their name out there as a good corporate citizen. Meaning they're far more interested in getting the newspapers, getting some photo ops, whatever, than actually making a tangible impact on the mission or cause. And, you know, we can look at this in terms of things like greenwashing, which is another sort of popular term, where a company like a laundry detergent company might put some cute animals on their products, implying that they're environmentally friendly, that they're safe, that they're helping the environment in some way, when in fact they're not at all. And there's really no law against putting, you know, a cute duck on your, you know, dish detergent and saying, this is green and it helps the environment. As long as you're not outright lying, there's no real, you know, breaking of the law. So this has led to some scrutiny and some healthy skepticism that if a corporation is saying they're doing a good thing, it could just be to mask something, you know, more evil that they're doing. Now, what's interesting about this, coming at it from a different point of view, is we often assume that the target of the corporation is the general public. But I mean, even just sort of, you know, rationally thinking about it, for a company like Coca-Cola or Nike or one of these big corporations, they don't really need a walk for the cure or a bike ride for the cure to raise awareness of their product. They already have, you know, peak market penetration. In fact, you know, for an organization like that, they're probably going to be way more successful in terms of awareness raising with a, you know, a well-polished commercial or PSA or advertisement. I mean, look at the sort of trendy popular advertisements that come on for, you know, soft drinks and the like. They don't really advertise the drink so much as advertise an attitude. That if you drink this, you're going to have, you know, attractive people dancing on your skyrise balcony in your fancy apartment. And I've, you know, I've never once seen a party like that before in my life. But nevertheless, they're not selling you on, Coke. The bubbly taste is so good. It's like a bunch of young people dancing around, you know, screaming and yelling and playing on the beach, and you're like, huh, that didn't really indicate that the pop is any good, but it looked like fun. I'm going to have one. And, you know, I think ironically is the truth is that those commercials probably do a lot more for them than sponsoring a bike ride. So then why do they do it? I mean, not to discount good, honest attempt to, you know, do good in the world. There is probably a very good reason that they focus on events like that, but it's not to target the general public. It probably targets their internal audience, their employees. Because at the end of the day, you know, a person who sells Coke or works for Coke has to go home and look themselves in the mirror and say, you know, today I sold 20 cases of a sugary soft drink. Woohoo! You know, it's not the most morally uplifting jobs, I suppose. And I think every industry has that problem. I mean, people come home from work, they want to think that they did a good job, that they have helped the world. But if your job is selling t-shirts or sneakers or soda pop, it's kind of hard to do that. So if your company is ethical, if your company is involved in the community, whether it's bike rides for conquering cancer or investing in a local library or building a playground, that's something that you can look at, you can get involved with, you can volunteer, you can fundraise for, and you can feel good about yourself. And you can look at yourself in the mirror and say, I'm not evil, my company's not evil, and look at all the good we've done. Now again, you know, your company may be evil, and maybe this sort of activity is, you know, really only kind of scratching the surface of the social sectors in terms of giving back to the community, but it's still something. And I think for a lot of nonprofits, when they partner with, you know, a big company, they keep in mind, you know, how are we going to engage with the employees and with their families and create an experience that they're going to value? Because at the end of the day, if you're a big company and you're going to throw, you know, a couple million dollars at a project, granted, for you, that's chump change. But you don't want to waste that chump change. You want to make a splash. And you want to make a splash with your employees. So you want them to go out there, have a good time, come home with a smile on their face and say, boy, you know, that CEO and those suits who came out to that event, they're good people. And, you know, they appreciate giving back to the community. So in a roundabout way of answering this question, I think that the question really is about what impact can a corporation have internally? What can it have to the people who have to wear that brand day in, day out? So with the question of pinkwashing or greenwashing, a lot of these corporations are approaching it from the point of view of not so much, are we actually helping the community? Are we actually addressing a place of harm or a place of need? Rather, they're focusing on what's the best way that we can make our employees appreciate what we've done. Now, again, that may not exactly be all that satisfactory. We may not be entirely pleased with that turn of events, but it sort of seems that that's the way things are going these days. Well, why don't we take a quick break here on the sector, and we'll return after this.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus. Go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, action, wizard, you shall not pass, cut! Sir Ian.
We are back on the sector here in CITR. So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about some social justice related issues. Now, many listeners are probably already familiar with the current news cycle regarding the ongoing tragedy that is the missing Aboriginal women here in Canada. I don't think I need to rehash how this is a national shame on Canada. It is a dark point, a black eye on the country, the likes of which we may never recover from. And it's obviously a tragic and sad situation. What I wanted to focus on is some recent remarks by our Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, who has declined to produce an inquiry into the Aboriginal women who are missing here in Canada, essentially citing that this is not part of a systemic problem of racism or mistreatment or dehumanization of the Aboriginal peoples of Canada, but rather simply another crime that needs to be investigated. Now, obviously, there are some major problems with how Prime Minister Harper is looking at the situation. It's slightly heartening to know that the tide of public opinion appears to be turning against this mistaken view. The various premiers of the provinces of Canada have called for an inquiry. Of course, First Nations groups across Canada are calling for an inquiry. The political opposition, in most cases, calling for an inquiry. Which leads to the question of why is Stephen Harper so dead set on this notion of taking a sociological view of crime? To answer this question, let's consider what does it mean to take a sociological view of crime? When we look at the sociology of crime, we're looking at it in a different context. We're looking at it from the point of view of its social context, not just individual behavior. It's not simply a question of people murdering other people. It's a question of why is this crime happening? What social states, what community aspects, what ongoing problems are contributing to this crime spree, that are contributing to the effect of having, in this case, significantly higher murder rates amongst Aboriginal women than anyone else in Canada. So when you look at it from a sociological point of view, you're examining cultural norms, you're examining communities, you're examining the expression of culture in a society, you're looking at the root causes that lead to contributing factors. Whether those factors are things like poverty or access to education or health services, things that can drive people into situations where they're vulnerable, things that can drive people to become perpetrators, to become criminals, things that can have an impact in terms of a societal context. So everything from work that's available, the educational standards that are available, healthcare standards that are available, all of those things will factor into a sociological view of crime. Now, the question is, well, why wouldn't somebody want to look at that? Well, one of the interesting aspects about sociology is that it takes a very holistic view of society, obviously, and it's going to focus in on everything, like I said, from education to healthcare. And if you start shining a light on these services and these programs and you find deficiencies that are leading to people flipping through the cracks, that's essentially admitting that society plays a major role in how individuals behave. Why would that be a problem? Well, if your political platform is based on this kind of firm notion of individual, of personal responsibility, of personal autonomy, and let's face it, the sort of conservative platform is based on that notion that if you're an individual and you commit a crime, it's your fault. You did it. Society doesn't have anything to do with it. And you'll be punished as an individual. You will not be given time off by, you know, taking into account that you grew up in a poverty-stricken area. No, no, no. That's not important. What's important is that you smoke pot, so you're going to jail for 5,000 years. So if you take a sociological point of view of crime, you're basically admitting to the fact that the individual, to a certain extent, is constructed and motivated by the society around them. And then if you find out that society is having a negative impact, you're bound to address those concerns and deficiencies in society. And again, that means looking at things like education and poverty and looking at healthcare and looking at the reach of Canadian society, who is being left out, who is being taken care of. And that sort of examination and research is not the sort of thing that conservatives seem all that interested in. So it's not really a big surprise that someone like Stephen Harper is hesitant to engage in this kind of dialogue with regards to the murdered Aboriginal women and this ongoing plight in Canada. When we start to take a look at crime in Canada, particularly towards Aboriginal women, we start to see some very, very troubling trends. In a recent Maclean's article I was just reading, an Aboriginal girl in Canada will likely die 10 years earlier than the national average. She is more likely to live in a crowded home, have less access to clean running water, more likely to be sexually or physically abused, greater chance of being addicted to tobacco, alcohol, drugs, and is more prone to life-threatening diseases like diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. And she is five times more likely than a non-Aboriginal person to meet a violent end at the hands of another. Just as disturbing, 23% of female murder victims are Aboriginal. When you consider the fact that Aboriginal people in Canada make up a, generally speaking, very small percentage, this dichotomy is shocking, absolutely terrible. And while conservatives like Stephen Harper and others in his government have been pointing at a solve rate by the RCMP and local police forces of around 90%, which is great, you know, police will likely find the killers in most situations. The point is, it's not simply good enough to track down the killers. It's time to address ahead of time why Aboriginal women are such a target for violence and are such a target for these ghastly statistics. It's just absolutely shocking when you look at them. And again, the counterpoint, of course, is that a big, expensive inquiry is going to slow down, you know, tracking down the murderers in this case. Well, there's no reason why the police have to stop what they're doing in terms of looking for the perpetrator and start doing paperwork. This inquiry needs to span Canadian society. It needs to not just include things like law enforcement. It needs to look at, as we mentioned, environmental factors, the circumstances around Native communities. It should be looking at education and healthcare, poverty rates, and the ability for an Aboriginal person to live, you know, the Canadian dream, getting a job, having a family, buying a house, all these things. It's not simply a question of a bunch of police officers standing around going, well, I don't know, did you go over to that neighborhood and look around, or I didn't go to that neighborhood. That sort of caricature of what an inquiry is just ludicrous. The real factor is that if Canada did have a genuine and encompassing inquiry, understanding the way society is working, understanding the sociological problems that are contributing to this, we may stand a better chance of not only catching more criminals, but preventing murders like this in the first place, of having a social safety net for people who are in vulnerable situations to safely get out of them and get their life back on track, of having a system in place that allows for a safety and security of everybody, not just, you know, the white middle class, but Aboriginal people, minorities of all different shape and sizes, so that we're not in a situation where we're constantly playing catch up. Sure, it's great that we have a 90% catch rate, but wouldn't it be better if we didn't need a 90% catch rate? If we were able to prevent these crimes from happening in the first place, so that 23% of female murder victims aren't Aboriginal, they're not that high in the first place. If we have a system in place that prevents this runaway, ghastly story from going on, we're not going to have to stand back and say, well, we have a 90% chance of catching the victim or catching the perpetrator. Well, great, but what about the victims? What about the people who have already died? I think that we owe them some justice in fixing the society that led to their death in the first place. One of the talking points that's come out of the debate, of course, is the notion of this, again, sort of ponderous, ongoing inquiry as opposed to direct action. And, you know, looking at some of the comments by certain conservative cabinet members and this claim that, you know, we don't need another over-the-top examination study on top of the additional 40 that we already have, you know, indicating that there's a problem. Well, if that's the case, then why hasn't anything been done yet? If we have this big pile of inquiries, you know, like sitting on the desk of the Prime Minister or sitting on the desk of the RCMP, why isn't anything being done about it? And I think that this, again, can speak to the need for a sociological point of view on crime. We're talking about a possibility, well, not a possibility, but a reality of systemic racism in this country. A systemic racist problem in terms of law enforcement, but also in terms of service to a population in this country, in terms of access to education and healthcare, of economic opportunity. If we know that Aboriginal peoples in Canada are underserved in those areas, and as the Conservative government is saying, you know, we don't need another study to tell us that, well, great, then act on the knowledge. If you're so keen on doing something, then do it. Let's see an action plan that addresses these issues. Let's start acknowledging the fact that there is systemic racism in this country and that it is directed at Aboriginal people and that that has been an ongoing problem for the history of this country. Of course, you know, action like this is not something that falls off a tree. It takes activism. It takes advocacy on the part of the public. It's good to see that there is a growing consensus in Canadian society and culture that we need to start addressing these issues from a sociological point of view. It's nice that the premiers are sort of on board with this. It's nice to see that the political opposition is taking advantage of the situation. I mean, again, politics, they're being good politicians by criticizing Stephen Harper, but at the very least, it's entering the public discourse that we need to take a different approach. This one-size-fits-all, this kind of individualistic approach to crime, not working. We need to start addressing things on a grander scale. And we need to find a way to transition from fact-finding and examining things to taking action based on what we learn. And of course, that's the big key. I mean, an inquiry that doesn't follow up with action is obviously worthless. I mean, nobody wants that, though. The goal is to an inquiry that leads to change or development or altering the course, at least, with regards to this terrible situation. So for listeners out there, and I know that many people will listen to this and go, that's right, but what can we do? Well, get politically active. Write to your MPs, write to your provincial MPs. Go online, track down where your local senator lives. They'll probably have information on how to contact them, how to write to them. Start doing it. I mean, it's not that difficult to book a meeting with an MP or a senator. I mean, they have to respond to you. It's the law. So start making that effort. Let's get politically active about this. Let's start talking about this on social media and making sure that it's front and center when it comes to what we want for the direction of this country. You know, it's a difficult task. It's overwhelming at times. It feels that way. But this is the point of social justice and what I hope that we can do here on the sector. Try to motivate people to start putting social justice front and center for what they want to see done in this country. Whether it's the way we vote, whether it's the way that we do activism, but let's make this more important for us. Hopefully we can make a difference. Hopefully something will get done and we can put an end to this blight on Canada's history. Well, we are running out of time here on the sector. It's always a bit interesting to end with a social justice segment like that because it does sort of fire you up and get you quite energized and frustrated and angry, which is good because it can motivate you to do stuff, but at the same time, it kind of leaves a bit of a frustration feeling inside you. So maybe what we can do is shift gears a little bit. We'll discuss the wonderful fact that school will be back in session, if not next week, the week after. So we'll have a whole bunch of students here on campus, perhaps some new listeners to the sector. So hopefully, welcome to the show, new listeners. We'll also have a great show next week. We're hoping to have with us Tom Watson, who is a columnist with Forbes. He writes in the philanthropy section of Forbes, has been writing some really great, interesting articles on the nonprofit charity sector. So we'll pick his brain and perhaps get his pitch of the week, as well as maybe we can get him to give us his take on the Ice Bucket Challenge, Slacktivism, and the changing face of the nonprofit world in terms of social media, development, fundraising. So send us your questions that we can ask Tom here on the show. Remember, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet and follow us on Twitter at sectorpodcast and at Ethan Clow. I'll answer both, so send me your questions to either one. And of course, we're on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And if you want to download the podcast or download our past episodes, they're all archived over at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And again, we'll have our show notes, all the references, all the details, all the facts from our episodes here in the sector. So go and check it out. Make sure that I'm not making things up, because that's really important. And again, as we're running out of time, we will see you next week here on the sector. Same time, same channel, same place. See you next week, folks.
I take two. Okay.